Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
My favorite Vietnam go-to song, featured in the Apocalypse Now. And so whenever I have Vietnam guys on, I play that on, so hopefully they'll start twitching. It always makes for a better interview. Joining me is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy, Mark Traynor. Mark, first of all, good morning. Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Thanks, Mac. Appreciate you having me.
All right. First of all, before we talk about the book, and the book is called A Quiet Cadence, it's a piece of, I don't know, I think the genre might be called faction. Factual events and with a little bit of fiction that allows, I think, some literary license. Karl Marlantis did much the same thing in Matterhorn. And so we'll talk about that in a minute, but we got to see if Mark passes the sniff test because we are Marines and we have to know if he's full of shit or not. So, Mark, born and raised where?
In Vermont, small town Vermont.
Not normally Marine land. So you're born and raised in Vermont. How does the Marine Corps ultimately – well, you go to the Naval Academy. How does that get on your radar? That's not a normal path for a kid.
You mean from Vermont to the Naval Academy? It's not. I'd never been south of New York when I left there at 17 to go to Annapolis. We're talking about 1964, when I actually went there as a plebe. And it was considered a real honor, at least in relatively conservative Vermont, you know. Well, lots of places in those days to receive an appointment to one of the service academies. And I was lucky enough to get one to Annapolis and went off and graduated from there in 1968 with my commission in the Marine Corps.
All right. So, but how does the Naval Academy get on your radar, though? I mean, even for a young kid, and you're a few years older than me, not that many, well, maybe about 10. And so I read history, the Scholastic Book Club that I was a member of at St. Charles Borromeo Elementary School. I used to wear the history section, especially the military history section of the book club out. And so I was a reader, and I knew about the Naval Academy. For whatever reason, I never thought that I could go there. Maybe it was so far away from where I lived in California. But how does the Naval Academy actually get on your radar? Who turns you on to that opportunity?
It's interesting, Mac, because I never actually knew anybody before I went there that had gone to the Naval Academy. And I knew a bunch of guys that had gone several years older than me to West Point. And they were kind of their high school heroes and all, and they were kind of heroes of mine. I actually got to go to West Point a couple of times to look around, and I started reading about all three of the service academies and really became enamored of Annapolis. And in fact, there's a little bit more of a twist to that story in that in those days in Vermont, all the boys that wanted to go to one of the service academies in the summer between their junior and senior years took a standardized exam geared towards selecting people for that. And because of where I stood on the exam, I was Senator George Aiken's nominee for wherever he had appointments. And he's the one that appointed me to the Naval Academy.
Wow. So that's interesting that it was a process of discovery and how impressed you were with peers. And it ultimately leads you there. So that's just getting to the Naval Academy. So you go to Annapolis. How does the Marine Corps then? Because truth be told, the Naval Academy has an incredible tradition relative to the Marine Corps, but it is a ship driving at that time, Submariner, right, and Black Shoe Navy and Brown Shoe Navy, which is the seagoing Navy, and to include the carrier aviation wing. How does the Marine Corps then get on your radar?
Well, it's interesting. I reported in as a plebe in June of 1964, and the Tonkin Gulf incident and the beginning of the war was later that summer. So my entire class, knew that there was a war on. Of course, we knew that there was a war on and began to pay pretty close attention to it. And some of the staff at the academy was made up of Marine officers at that time, and I had a great deal of respect for them. And I followed what was going on with the Marines in Vietnam. And back in those days, they allowed – everybody was a volunteer that went into the Marines, but they allowed about 10% of each class to volunteer to go into the Marine Corps. And today it's up closer to 25 or 26%, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. So I was one of the guys that I guess from my plebe year through the next 3 years, I was always convinced I wanted to be a Marine.
That's interesting because it's not the path. It wasn't the path well traveled, and certainly again, Navy's got a great Annapolis has a great tradition of contributing to the Marine Corps, and that's just interesting. So you become now you head to the Marine Corps, and of all things, you become an infantry officer. How does that make sense to you? Was that your choice? Were you voluntold? How does that happen?
No, that was my choice. I sometimes joke with people that the reason I went into the Marines is because I run faster than I swim, and I like dirt. And so when I went to the basic school, the class was divided up when we selected branches into all of the various branches of the Marine Corps. And I had always thought that, the guys that there were a lot of impressive Marines, no matter what they were doing, in my judgment, back in those days, still today. I just thought that the epitome of being a Marine officer was to be an infantry officer.
Well, you're not wrong about that.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, I know there's everybody else, all the other haters out there that say, all Marine officers are the same. We infantry officers know that that's not true. And they know they know that's true. They know they're the knaves of the Marine Corps. And then if you want to be somebody, if you want to be a made man in the Marine Corps, there is a path to that. But it's not simple. Now you go and you get assigned to Bravo Company 15, not Charlie Company. But you then later on, and we'll talk about your Vietnam experience, but then you go back and you're a battery commander? How does that happen?
Well when I came home from Vietnam, I switched my MOS from infantry to artillery.
Why would you give up your man card, for God's sake?
I didn't quite think of it in those terms, actually.
Nobody did.
I had injured my feet while I was in Vietnam. Wasn't wounded there, but had some problems for some reason with some kind of bone structure thing in my feet. And so I figured that if I was going to make a career out of the Marine Corps, and couldn't walk 50 miles like the guys that the other guys that were grunts, I ought to find another combat arm where I could do what I ought to do. And so I switched artillery and went out to Fort Sill to the Army Officers Basic Artillery Course, which is where all Marines that were headed into artillery, all Marine officers, went, because the Marine Corps doesn't have its own artillery school. And we had a very interesting class. 99 officers in the class, 49 of us were Marines, and I think we took six out of the top 10 places in the class rank when we graduated. So it was an interesting thing, and of course, we Marines had quite a bit of fun with the Army instructors out there and our peers. I guess it's fair to say we probably terrorized most of them, but it was a good time.
And I think it's always interesting in those basic classes when you have more experienced officers, right? And they bring something to the table in addition to, you know, just, you know, a lot of novices. There's some prior enlisted guys in every class, but for the most part, it's, you know, it's novices. And then when you get people that have actually been there and done it, it's certainly a different perspective that gets brought to those classes. So that must have been a very, very interesting experience. Truth be told, though, that artillery shit is pretty easy, right? I mean, for God's sake, we all know they train chimps to do that. Yes?
Now, far be it from me to disparage my fellow cannon cockers.
Okay, look, I teed that one up for you, and I have artillery guys that listen to this. Don't fail me.
You know, there's a poster that's out at Fort Sill that is an interesting take on it all, and it says this picture of a guy standing next to a, you know, it's a cartoon of a guy standing next to an old-fashioned cannon, and he's pulled the lanyard, and there's a cannonball going through the air towards this melee of people beating the daylights out of each other a ways down the range. And the caption is, "Artillery lends dignity to what would otherwise be a vulgar brawl."
You know, they've always got a slant on it. You know, they're always a little bit smarter. Them and St. Barbara and all that nonsense. So how long do you stay in the Marine Corps?
A total of 5 years. Really had a wonderful experience in the Marine Corps. Went from Fort Sill down to Camp Lejeune and was in an artillery battalion down there and eventually became a battalion commander. I actually commanded a Kilo Battery of 410, which was mechanized 155s. They look kind of like almost like a tank with a gigantic gun on it. And one of the most fun things about all of that is we got to go do a jungle exercise on the island of Viegas, not far from Cuba, where we were still using it as a bombing and training range. And I'll spend about 6 weeks down there tearing around the jungle and shooting artillery at targets. And then I was asked to be, I guess I tossed my hat in the ring, so it wasn't like I was exactly asked, but I became the aide to the commanding general of the 2nd Marine Division, which was a very fascinating way for a, 23-year-old guy to watch somebody run a 25, 28,000-person organization around half the hemisphere.
Who was the commanding general?
Robert Bohn, B-O-H-N, and he died a number of years ago. Brilliant man, incredibly hard charging. I think some people who have accused me over my latter career of having some workaholic tendencies, I learned it all from General Bohn, and he let me, you know, he let me in on virtually everything. I attended almost all of the meetings with him. Got to handle a lot of his speech writing and correspondence. Flew all over the place with him, so it was an eye-opening experience for a young guy.
Now, it must have been extremely interesting because guys like that, I mean, they joined the Marine Corps. They were World War II Marines, and so, I mean, virtually their entire careers, they were World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and their experiences. I just looked him up. He participated in the Philippine campaign, the Battle of Iwo Jima. It also says the Battle of Okinawa, although I don't know too many people that participated in both. The Battle of Incheon, the Battle of the Pusan Perimeter, the Second Battle for Seoul in Vietnam, the Tet Offensive. Holy smokes, right?
He was a real deal.
Yes, yeah, two Silver Stars, two Purple Hearts, and he was a sports club owner.
Yeah, he was a brilliant man, too. I mean, just an amazing intellect. And, you know, it was at that point in time that I used to tell a lot of people that you may not know too much about the military, but the guys that are running the show, like Bob Bone, I never called him Bob, mind you,
right.
You know, could run the biggest corporations in the world because he really was just amazing at what he could do.
And the reason he was involved in both Iwo Jima and Okinawa because he was part of the ship's detachment.
I think he was on a battleship at that time, if
right,
I recall.
Right. The so interesting. So you get out of the Marine Corps, and what did you want to be? What did you do?
Well, there's one more step in there. I went from the 2nd Division after I finished being the general's aide. I went back up to Quantico for about a year or so, year and a half, I guess. And I was a staff platoon commander there at the basic school.
How cool of a job is that? I mean, I was stationed there and did 3.5 years at the basic school, and now we have the infantry officer course that I don't think was probably there when you went through. But I think guys who came back from Vietnam said, yeah, we should probably have a little bit more individual instruction of the infantry MOS before we send everybody over there. So I got a chance to do that. But I look back on that as one of not only my time with teaching lieutenants, but my time with so many other captains there. And you learn so much about the Marine Corps. You learn all the stuff you were supposed to learn the first time, second time when you're teaching it. But I had a wonderful experience there.
Yeah. When were you there, Mac?
I was there 1989 to 1992.
Okay. Okay. As my son went through in 94 and went through IOC after the basic school. And then he came back several years later and taught it both.
Nice.
So, yeah. Yeah. That was neat. It was great duty. You know, the young lieutenants were so hard charging and really so anxious to be getting going as Marine officers and all. It's just an amazing tour.
All right. So now you at the basic school, at that point you exit the Marine Corps, and then where do you go? What do you become?
Yeah, I went to law school directly after I left the Marines and at the University of Maryland, and graduated from there in 76, and then practiced law in a large firm in Baltimore for a number of years, then started my own firm. And then after doing all of that for probably close to 20 years or so, ended up moving back south, and I was the general counsel at what was then Wachovia Corporation, very large financial services company in Charlotte, North Carolina, for another 10 years. And then came back to my old firm in Maryland for a couple of years and then have been doing mostly business stuff since then.
Now, I read someplace that you were you've also been, though, involved in government work, or at least consulting for the government internationally in different places that are very challenging. Tell me about that. How does that happen, and what were those positions?
Yeah, it's been fascinating. I tried to kind of keep my hand in with military or veterans type stuff in the early 80s. I was part of a group that the Reagan administration put together called the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program, and I ran part of that as a volunteer. It wasn't a full-time government job at all, and made some contacts there. And then later on, I became a member of the board of the National Defense University. And some of the things that you're referencing there were in connection with that. And they made other contacts. And so I got to go on very short trips, a week or two at a time to some of the hotter spots throughout Africa, and a little bit of time in Yemen. Got to spend, a week or so flying around looking at different things in Iraq. So it was very worthwhile. I think made a tiny bit of a contribution to stuff, perhaps, and at the same time was a great deal of fun, you know, to be out there with the guys who have really really got the boots on the ground and really doing what they're supposed to do.
The places that you mentioned, Iraq, I saw Yemen, Africa. Could you see the future that, you know, that would materialize? Could you see this collision between the Islamic world at that time and the United States and the Western world? Could you see that coming or not?
Actually, it was after it came. For example, I was in Iraq just as the surge was getting going in, 2007, I guess. And part of what I was doing over there, or what I was doing over there, was there was a group of us at the Defense Department put together just to go around to various places and try and help them figure out some of the economic situation, because there were so many people that had been put out of jobs and out of their businesses. And, you know, I came home saying, if you've got 60% unemployment in Baltimore, you'll probably end up having bomb factories there too. You know, it was just, you could see where a lot of the terrorist activity was caused, by the way that things had gone down in Iraq, I think. But
let me ask you, as a Vietnam veteran, one of the things that you know that's been interesting when I talk to Vietnam veterans is the pain they felt, because you know one of their great claims to fame in Desert Storm, the crowning achievement, was America in the aftermath of Vietnam did not get involved in these endless wars, that one of the lessons that they had learned, and that Vietnam guys who had served in the Pentagon and served at the upper echelons of each services were adamant about, is that we will not fight wars that aren't clearly defined with clear end states. And, you know, Desert Storm was kind of the crowning achievement of that. And then, you know, you got to watch as the nation reenacted Vietnam, which was Don Rumsfeld starring as Robert McNamara. He had a better way. And we get involved in wars that we don't have what is known as phase four clearly articulated. And I remember when I got to Iraq in 2004, I went back with the 1st Marine Division. I worked for General Mattis. And so I get to sit in on all these meetings. And slowly but surely, it occurs to me there isn't really a plan. Ambassador Bremer, we disbanded the military. We stopped paying their pensions. And we didn't have a plan for securing the country. And Secretary Rumsfeld had rejected General Shinseki's fidelity to the war plan that said you had to have approximately 300,000 people there in order to keep the lid on the thing, or you would have a civil war. And so this thing was going to hell. Was it painful as a Vietnam guy to watch the country go down that road again?
Absolutely. You know, when I was there, you're painting the exactly right picture. And that was in 2007. And mind you, 13 years later, we've still got some stuff going on over there. And, you know, it makes you wonder if our civilian leadership in particular ever thinks through what the actual realistic end state of incursions ought to be and how we ought to plan for them. I mean, you hit the nail on the head, Mac. There was zero plan, as far as I'm aware, for any kind of phase four activities in Iraq. And, you know, our military is great at doing exactly what they are tasked with doing, but you've got to define that task. And, we seem to define it on a very short-term basis without figuring out where we're going to go for an end state. And I think we've seen that in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
No, it's been awful. And, you know, I talk about it here on a regular basis. And I've been fortunate enough to get to know guys like General Zinni, General Van Riper. And, you know, when you have them on, you hear them talk about it. You know, it's like, look, it's the lesson we learned in Vietnam. We paid for it in Vietnam, and then we reenacted the whole thing again in both countries, the expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan to create something that's never existed on the planet, and you thought you could do that in how many months? You know, and so to hear them talk. And so let me ask you a question. So I think the folly of civilians will be is just part of the human condition. How about the responsibility of uniformed military officers, in particular the general officers of the United States military, to prevent these things? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that that's a in a way both a simple and a complex issue in the sense that it is clearly the obligation of our senior military officers to come up with good plans, to give the best possible advice that they can to the civilian leadership. At the end of the day, the civilian leadership under our Constitution has direct control of the military. And, you know, you can give all the advice that you want. I mean, I think General Shinseki is a case in point. He spoke truth to power as far as talking about and recommending what he thought the force ought to be to go into Iraq. He was not only ignored, he was punished for it.
Right.
You know, and then people that went from there after him really didn't have a choice in that no matter what they recommended, somebody else makes the ultimate political decision, which is what it is at the end of the day, on what we're going to do when we're dealing with other countries. That's not literally a military decision. It's a political one. And the political masters can get all the advice that you want to give them. Now, I don't know that that advice is always the best, but I would hope, and I tend to believe that most of the very senior military people think things through pretty well and present options, but the best options don't always get picked. And part of that, I think, is that you know, you don't have people that are, largely speaking, you don't have people that are in the White House or in the Defense Department or the State Department that, for the most part, this is a generalization, but sure, for the most part, that are really steeped in military type history. So I think that's a weakness. I think that those folks need to pick good people around them that actually understand what it means to put boots on the ground someplace and what the consequences of that are going to be, not only to the military that go to the fight, but to the population that is on the ground where they're fighting. Because, you know, as we saw in Iraq, and you just alluded to, when you put virtually everybody out of work, I had a conversation with a civilian senior government guy over there, and maybe it was part of my Vietnam vet stuff coming out, but I said to him, you know, this is just ridiculous. We have closed down all of the businesses, so these people, including a lot of young men, can't make a living, can't support their family. Of course they're going to create an insurgency. And he said, well, it's better to do it that way because capitalism will rise from the ashes. And I used a couple words I probably shouldn't use on the air and just said, you know, that's just crazy. That's just crazy to think you can destroy something utterly and hope that our way of life is going to rise out of those ashes. Or our economic system is going to rise out of it. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
But you didn't punch him in the face.
Yeah, I did not punch him.
he probably could have used that. No, it's that folly. I remember thinking, like, where's the State Department? Where's USAID? I mean, in my mind's eye, and we had a major come back doing the first inventory that we did with the Iraqi, Iraqi police and the National Guard that was being stood up, and it was just a shit show. And he came back with a piece of binder paper that was ripped the top left corner was ripped, and in pencil were the names of the police officers. And he said, these are the names of the police officers that are on the rolls. And I expect that a fair number of these aren't actually on the rolls. It's just the way they pad their payroll for the chief of police, and then he uses that money for himself and other things that he does. There's no radios. They have their own weapons, and there's no vehicles. And I remember, aren't the logistics guys going to say, okay, let me give you an update on this. There's a ship that has radios, weapons, and vehicles that will be in the port at Kuwait, on this date. And then, but in the meeting, it was just crickets. That's it?
Yeah.
Well, what are we supposed to do about that? And you just look for these other organizations, and they just weren't there. And so it was stunning. So what have we done to these people, in our vision? And that's what was so disturbing. I'll ask you one more question, and then obviously we'll talk about the book. Are we in a day and age when general officers need to be quicker to resign? Over policy issues?
I guess my own answer to that is, probably, in my view, probably not unless it is a really, really dramatic issue. Because once you've resigned, and we've seen this happen historically back in the 70s, I can't recall names, but I remember it happened with a couple of senior people. The idea that they can have real influence on the outside is very fleeting. And do I think that a statement like that ought to get made every once in a while? Yes. But I think for the most part, it's kind of like throwing a rock into the pond. There's a splash when it happens, and a day later, the ripples have smoothed out and things keep going the way they were. Whereas if a really talented senior officer stays in the military, he might have the opportunity to have some influence, even if it takes them a while to get there. Now, of course, there are going to be issues that call for resignation. I applauded what General Mattis did, and he decided to leave as Secretary of Defense. There are certain lines that you just can't cross.
I think I would disagree with you based on, our actions in both Iraq and Afghanistan we've been escorted to those policy disasters by the flag officers and the general officers of the United States military. And I think that we're now in a day and age that the most senior people, cannot perform the role of bobblehead for an administration that clearly wants to do ridiculous things with the thought that I can do more inside than I can outside. I think that in this day and age that you have to call bullshit on it, and you have to put it in front of the American people, because it's immoral to do what we've done. It's immoral to do it to the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's immoral to ask young Americans to die and their families to pay an incredible sacrifice for something that you're not committed to. And clearly, we were looking to unass, we do it every 4 years when the election rolls around, that we're going to get out. And if that's as far as our commitment goes, then to me, you have a moral obligation, because general officers are great for lecturing guys like you at Bravo and Bravo 1-5 about your moral obligation, blah, blah, blah. Well, what about theirs? To say we don't have enough people there. You went there during the surge. We knew that in 2004, but nobody came back and said it. What about their moral obligation in terms of expanding the ground war, that fool's errand in Afghanistan, to create what? A Federal Republic of Afghanistan? And what we're seeing now through their negotiations is that it will go back to the way it has always been, which is warlords running cities, the Taliban running the countryside, and they will find either a way to coexist, or that war will continue forever, much like it has. And so if the military people won't stand up and tell the truth and won't throw that carcass in front of the American people, then who does? And I think the answer to that is nobody, which is pretty scary. So Not that I have a strong opinion about that, but I might.
Yeah, it didn't sound like it. Yeah. Well, I think the point that you're making is an important one in this respect, my way of thinking about it, that, you know, you take a look, for example, at Afghanistan, and I can't remember, but it's been a lot of various commanders that we've had on the ground there. And yet when you see anything about the congressional testimony, at least the open committee hearings and all, it's a difficult situation, but we're making progress, or it's a difficult situation, but, you know, we may be able to turn the corner coming ahead. Well, that's been going on for how many years now? And it's always just a difficult situation, but we're dealing with it. You know, we're really not dealing with it in a way that we ought to be.
Well, and again, I think for Vietnam guys, it would be, and you know, General Zinni, General Van Riper, the guys I've spoken to the most about this stuff, you know, they said it's just been awful to watch because we thought the nation learned these lessons and that we've gone down this road again and two protracted wars, America looking for a way out. Peace with honor, if you will, to quote President Nixon, and kind of navigating our way through elections, and this is an election issue, and so it's been interesting, especially I would think if you're a Vietnam veteran. Let's talk about where does the book come from. So you come back, you're a busy guy, you have a family, and you're involved professionally with some pretty substantial businesses and work. Where does the idea of the book come from?
I think a combination of things. Part of it grew out of the work that I did with the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program, and the way that one of the things we attempted to do in that was to have an impact on how Vietnam vets were viewed throughout the country. And so someplace in the back of my head was always the idea that Vietnam veterans had not been accurately portrayed for the most part in the press. And in fact, quite the opposite in many, many instances. So that kind of percolated for a while. And then I got interested in writing about Marines on the ground in Vietnam. There had been some other very good novels about that. But a few years back, what really came to me was that I wasn't aware of any novel. There's some very good war novels out there. I wasn't aware of any novel that combined a very authentic, hard-hitting, if you will, look at a young Marine grunt in infantry combat on the one hand, and then on the other hand, what it was like after he came home. And my thesis was that most veterans, and I think that the book actually, and in fact, I've heard from other veterans about this, that the book actually, while it takes place in Vietnam and the years after the war, it really applies to all of our veterans, because I don't think that combat vets have been portrayed very well in the press, number one. And number two, I don't think that there's a book out there that combines this this really tough look at ground combat with the concept that after someone comes home from war, he may not be disabled in any psychological way or anything. He may go on, and these days he or she may go on to be a good spouse, a good parent, you know, a good employee and worker, and coaches the kids' little leagues teams and stuff like that. But everybody that has been in combat, I believe, and I haven't had anybody contradict me yet that knew what they were talking about, I believe that everybody who's been in combat has things inside their heads that are memories and griefs about losses. And so in A Quiet Cadence, the novel, it talks about the protagonist, a guy by the name of Marty McClure, is a good role model. He's a good father. He's a good husband. He's a high school English teacher, et cetera, et cetera. But he's living with the ghosts inside his head of his friends who are killed or horribly maimed. And at the same time, he is watching the almost endless war of Vietnam go directly down the drain with probably nothing at all accomplished by the time we left Saigon. And
all right, stop that. You're getting a little bit too close to sensitive feelings about Iraq and Afghanistan. Your experience is essentially timeless. Well, at least for Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. So how do you arrive at the vehicle, which is Carl Marlantis, who wrote this, there's a series of little reviews for the Naval Institute Press publication that they did on your book. Quote from Carl Marlantis, author of the book Matterhorn, and also What It's Like to Go to War. And he's also written a book called Deep River. He's been on this program a few times, and so he's an interesting guy. Quote, a great read. Few books moved me to tears. This one did. For every combat veteran who has dealt with coming home, a quiet cadence makes it clear that you are not alone. I'll read you one more little review, and this is from the patron saint of the Marine Corps, J.N. Mattis. Quote, a must-read book for any American who wants to understand war and its impact on those we send into combat. Mark Trainor sets the standard for an authentic description of combat and what our infantry veterans carry with them when they return home. Savage yet compassionate, a quiet confidence will take its place as one of the most telling narratives of the war and its aftermath. So how do you settle on the literary vehicle that you choose and why? Why this book of faction, if you will?
I wanted to do it as a novel so that you could really get inside the characters' heads. I think that there's the opportunity to sometimes show more truth through fiction than there is through fact because of how you can actually depict characters and situations. The novel is very fact-based, of course, partly my own experience. It's not a memoir. It is not about me. But there's a lot of experience, both myself and people that I knew or was with, that goes into a lot of the book. So I thought that I could take a series of characters. And while I was an officer, I wanted to write it about an enlisted man because I thought that that might be more impactful. What I was hoping was that there would be three types of readers for the book. One would be Vietnam vets and people that cared about them. The second would be vets of our more recent wars and folks that cared about them. And then three, people that just wanted what I hope is a well-written story. And it's the latter group that I hoped would come to understand what it really is like to be a 19 or 20-year-old kid on the ground in combat, and what you experience and what you become to some degree, and then what you live with when you come home. That's why I wanted to do it as a combination of both the war novel and the post-war novel in one book.
Got it. You don't know this, but one of the things that I do here is I've created a presentation. I'm through the second draft of the book, or I'm into the second draft of the book, of something that I called post-traumatic winning. And I had a whole variety of traumatic experiences, some professional, three combat deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan as an infantry guy, and then a whole series personally of murder in my family, people dying, one of my two younger sisters freezing to death, training accidents in which a helicopter crashes into my assembly area out of 29 Palms and the pilot's decapitated. We're trying to save the three other guys, and everybody dies. And so I couldn't get away from this stuff. And so I started this podcast, All Marine Radio, and one of the unstated horizontal themes is post-combat related mental health. So I meet Mark. I see the review of Mark's book, and somehow somebody forwards it to me and says, you should get this guy on or something like that. And so he forwards me this stuff. Now, Mark doesn't know that I do this thing called post-traumatic winning. And I'll tell you, Mark, that last week I spent 3 days with the Marines and sailors from the 15th MU that just lost 9 comrades in a in that Amtrak accident. The CG-01 MEF, I had worked with his guys at when he was a CG of the 2nd Marine Air Wing, and he said, hey, would you come, you know, would you come speak and talk to these guys? And I said, absolutely. So I read this last night. This is a review done by a guy named Tom Glenn in a publication called the Washington Independent Review of Books. At the heart of A Quiet Cadence is the damage combat does to a warrior's soul. McClure, one of the characters, is permanently scarred. He describes it thus, quote, in Vietnam, we tried to compartmentalize our worst traumatic experiences, put everything, the sights, the sounds, the smells, and fears, in a box and put the box on a shelf. It was years before I could come. I took some of those boxes down, more years before I stopped opening some of them. Sometimes even now, some lids pop off when I'm not expecting them to. Then the reviewer goes on. Early on, Garofano, another character, warns McClure about the blackness that darkens the soul as a result of combat. Talk to me about conveying your experience relative to trauma, because here's what I do. I tell people that there's a path that you can walk after trauma enters your life that can take your life to a great place. I didn't expect that I would live the life that I live today, which is the trauma that I've experienced is now a window into the lives of other people who have suffered traumatic experiences. And they don't need to be combat experience. They could be being raped. They could be victims of child abuse or any form of trauma. But that our traumatic wisdom that comes out of our culture, right, you can take it with you through that window and you can give that to them. And as Frankl describes in Man's Search for Meaning, which I didn't read till after I experienced all of this, to include giving this stuff to other people, when you transform somebody else's life with the traumatic wisdom of, I say, primarily the enlisted Marine Corps, which has benefited me, you transform your own life. And so I'm curious about your traumatic experiences, because that seems to be such a theme in the book, is that everybody dealing with the trauma that they dealt with and ultimately how they do that. So that obviously is a strong theme in the book. When you thought about writing it, how did you want to convey and what did you want to convey?
I guess I started with the premise that I talked about a couple minutes ago, Mac, that I believe that despite what's largely been depicted in the popular press and in some literature that is some fiction, at least, that has dealt with combat veterans, I believe that while there are clearly folks that have got tremendous issues and they need professional help working their way through the trauma that they experienced and its aftermath, I think that probably the majority of guys and now gals that have been through real personal trauma, while undoubtedly I'm sure counseling can be very, very helpful for them, but I think in many instances that it's a matter of finding someone that you trust to talk with. There's a scene in the book that I think conveys some of my thoughts about it. Marty is home. He's only been home for a couple of weeks, and his father asks him if he wants to talk about what Vietnam was like for him. And he says, no, I don't want to deal with it at all. And without saying the words out loud, he's also saying, you know, despite the fact that all the pictures hang on the walls of my mind and make horrible noises at me at night. And then he goes on to say, I wish that I had known then that all I had to do was, or that not that all I had to do, I wish that I had known then that help had been available if I had just accepted it at the time or asked for it at the time. It would have saved me years of trying to figure out what was going on inside my head. And I think that that's part of it, is that finding people that you trust, that you can actually let your hair down a little bit with and explain what goes on. And those people, though, have to be folks that aren't going to be judgmental, aren't going to think that you're crazy. It's just you have issues that that bother you. And that can go on for a very, very long time, if not forever.
I want to tell you a quick story of how I become the beneficiary of wisdom that comes through. It comes via Vietnam, but I don't think that's where it originated. This incident of the helicopter crash that happened 27 years ago next month. The helicopter crash happens. You know, we medevac two Marines that were still living. We then look for body parts to include the head of the pilot. And the coroner comes out, and so it's a pretty busy day. My gunny, who was at the ammunition supply point, 29 Palms, ultimately comes out, and he walks up to me. I'm sitting on probably two or three cases of MREs, washing blood off my hands and forearm, and he walks up to me and goes, "Hey, Skipper," he said, "how are you doing?" And I looked at him, and I said, "You know, I don't really know. I've been busy. I haven't thought about it." And he looked down at me, and he said, "You know you're never going to get over this." And I looked at him and I said, in a very elaborate way, "Get the fuck away from me, man." And he looked down at me and said, "No." And I said, "Who told you that shit?" And he said, "Vietnam guys, and it's good advice." And the single best advice I ever received in my life, I got that day within 3 hours of the event from my company, Gunny. It's echoed through my life. I've given it as often as I can. And I can't tell you how right you are, because I think unless you have a serious mental illness, which is a very small fraction of the population and a very small fraction of the DOD, that if somebody will simply look at you and tell you the truth and say, okay, this is the truth, this is what you got to do, then most of us can do that. But I think we go into a system that wants to that is more than willing to medicate us. That yeah, you can come talk about your stuff. Well, how does that get me to a good place? And the unvarnished truth from veterans, I will tell you, is magical. One, stop faking it. Among people that you care that care about you and you can be honest with, don't fake it with them. Know this, that trauma is a normal part of life. Most people go through it. Not everybody in combat. You know, some of them go through, you know, I tell the story. My sister saw her two sons murdered by their father, both shot in the head, 4 and 6 years old. Now, I know a lot of guys that are war heroes. None of us have seen, right? None of us are in that zip code. I tell the story of Elizabeth Smart, you know, kidnapped at the age of 14, raped every day for 9.5 months. You know, so we come back with our own version of trauma, but we're not special. And that's if, you know, that's a good thing, because a lot of people not only live good lives, but they live great lives, and you could do that too. That trauma is trauma is trauma, so it doesn't matter your source of origin, that you've got to talk about your shit, that feeling damaged is normal about it, that if you don't stay physically fit, if you don't stay away from alcohol, and if you don't keep your money in order, you have a chance to be a shit show for the rest of your life. And you've got to learn about wellness and how to keep yourself physically and mentally well, and that's not bullshit. When you hear that from veterans, it's all 100% true. And I call it the enlisted wisdom of Marines. Not of the Marine Corps institutionally, but of Marines. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And I will tell you, that's what 95% of us need, that don't have infrastructure damage in our heads. We need somebody to lay out the unvarnished truth and say, and let me tell you this, if you live this way And then every person that you meet that's struggling, if you give this wisdom to them, you'll change their life and watch what happens to your life. They look at you and say, who the hell are you? And I say, look, I'm somebody who got my head shoved under this water over and over again. And I never thought I'd be doing this, but it's what I've learned from all these other great Marines and veterans that have taught me this shit. And I'm telling you, no bullshit. You can take this thing and you can turn it into a positive life. And I know that sounds crazy as fuck, but I'm here to tell you that that's the truth. If you spend your life changing other people's, and you use terms I use, this term darkness, right? That is straight up the term for it, right? This term trauma, that is straight up the term for it. And you, if you go around and you help people see that path and you change their life, you'll live a life that you can't even fathom right now. And so your book, in my opinion, is so spot on. And then, you know, just the things that you've said about it coming from another veteran who you respect. And every time and I'm sure you're like me, some days you can talk about this stuff and it's easy. Other days, you know, I get emotional about it and I can feel myself. I can feel the tears in my eyes talk when I begin to talk. And when that happens to me, I hear my company Gunny talking to me. There's nothing wrong with you. You can't go through this shit and it not stick to you. So whenever it bothers you, don't fucking worry about it, man. It's normal. You're a human being. There's nothing wrong with you. All this is normal for after you've gone through what you've been through. And I just want to say that as I've read your stuff, I just want to congratulate you, man. You've hit it. You know, you've hit it right on the screws.
Well, I really appreciate that, Mac. You know, just a couple of thoughts on what you're saying. I think it's so key, and this is one of the things that I think the book teaches, I hope, is that you're not alone, you know, and you have to understand that the things that are going on in your own head, you're not the only one that's got it, and it doesn't make you some kind of a bad person or some kind of a weird person or anything. There's a clip on the book there, or a blurb from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, and he said that it's his belief that every person who has ever been in a firefight, and you're right about all the other types of trauma too, has some sort of stress, post-traumatic stress associated with that. It doesn't necessarily have to rise to the level of a disorder, but it's there. It's going to be in your head. It's going to be there for a very long time, if not forever. You ought to be thinking about that and working to find folks that can help you deal with it. And again, those don't have to be professional counselors. They can just be other people that know something about it. You can read about it. I got a wonderful email from a Vietnam vet about the book, and I don't know that he's correct about this. I'm sure it's very much of an overstatement, but he said, you know, if you could get a tremendous number of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans to read this book, you'd probably help cut down on the suicide rate among vets. I don't know if that's true.
I do. It's straight up true because that's what I do. I go and talk about this stuff, and you'll laugh when you hear this, Mark, but I'll do it with Marines, right? And I just did it last week. And I stand up there, and you know how much they want to be there to talk about mental health and trauma and PTSD, right? They're like, fuck, yeah. I got to go to this shit. Like, I didn't want to kill myself until I found out I had to go to 2.5 hours of this. You know, now I do, right? That's them. So I walk in and say, look, I'm here to tell you the truth. And this is the traumatic wisdom from predominantly enlisted Marines, because the officers and the senior staff NCOs are faking it too much. Okay, so the majority of the Marines that you're going to hear in this presentation are going to be, you're going to hear 3 sergeants, you'll hear a corporal, you'll hear 3 lance corporals and a PFC. That's everyday Marines. And they're going to tell you no bullshit stuff. So that's what this presentation is. And so I'm here to tell you the truth, and if you don't like it, I don't much give a fuck. And so that's not your normal introduction to mental health shit, but you can imagine in an audience of Marines, you know what they do? They look at it and they're like, awesome. Like, who is this dude, man? Where'd he come from? Like, who is this guy speaking our own language to us? And so I'm going to tell you that that's exactly the truth. And It's amazing the conversations that I have with Marines that look at me and say, it felt like you were speaking to me the whole time you were talking. And I always say, I was, man. Don't you know anything? I was speaking to you, exactly to you. And then they'll tell me these crazy stories, which I'm sure you've got letters of that their traumatic experiences started out when they were young. They were physically abused or sexually abused, and then they went to Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam, and then they had, you know, more stress piled onto that, and then they chose to drink and self-medicate. And so I believe 100% in my experience is the exact same as yours, as your experience is. And it was amazing for me to read last night, given my experiences. And here, just recently, you know, last week, I spent, you know, 3 days with the Marines and Sailors of the 15th MEU, with all the things that somebody could recommend that they do. The commanding general of 1MEF, you know, who had seen what I do, he said, no, this is the kind of help that they need. And so it was last night. It was amazing me reading what you thought. And I thought, you know what? I've never spoken to Mark in my life until we did a little bit of technology check yesterday, because it's Mark's wife that makes all this shit happen. He's a lot more. Exactly. He's just the artist, right? She's the brains in all of this. But anyway, but it was amazing reading last night. I mean, at one point I had a, you know, my whole body like ringing. I'm like, holy shit, I've never met this guy, and he and I have come to the exact same conclusions about this stuff. And so I was really kind of anxious to, if you can't tell, to do this interview and to talk about, you know, the deeper meaning of your book and how you use these characters. And I think the fictional part of what you, the reason to use fiction, I think it is important. And Carl Marlana said very, very similar things, why he used, a fictional vehicle as, with, the historical setting of his experience, was because it allowed you to more fully tell the story. It allowed you to composite characters and things like that. And so I want to applaud you for what you've done, because I do believe you're absolutely positively correct. And as I go around and I do more of this, and I see the reaction, you know, I see the reaction of young Marines who come up, or young women that come up, you know, with tears running down their face and say, why didn't anybody tell me I'd never get over it? And I said, yeah. I don't know. That comes from Vietnam guys. And I said, and look, if you've ever met Vietnam guys, they're not the brightest bulbs in the chandelier. Where did they get that? I said, probably World War II and Korea and Vietnam guys. World War II and Korea guys. Well, where did they get it? Guys who fought in Bellwood, guys who fought in the Philippines, guys who fought in Latin America? This is the oral tradition of the Marine Corps that you and I are stewards of how you do get through this stuff, and that there is nothing wrong with you. And so to me, it's just I think what you've done is wonderful. I want to ask you about the characters that you choose. How close are the characters in the book to people in real life, or did you have to composite them or make some of them up in order to craft the story that you told?
Yeah, none of the characters individually are actually based on any given individual. There are, you know, various and assorted characteristics for any number of them that come together in different ways, and sometimes they're interchangeable. You know, not interchangeable, but the parts are, in the sense that if a scene in the book is based in part on something that actually occurred to Sam Smith, it may involve somebody very different in the book. I think that they're pretty representative of the types of guys that I was with in Vietnam. But you wouldn't be able to put your finger on an individual and say that's who it was.
Got it. What kind of response have you got from the guys you served with who had similar experiences. And again, we didn't talk about your Vietnam experience, but you go to Vietnam and you're with 1-5 in 1969 to 1970. 1-5 is west of Da Nang. And tell everybody about where you operated.
Yeah, the area that I operated in was a very heavily booby-trapped area. So while there were occasional pitched firefights, the biggest thing that people really had to worry about on a day-to-day basis was the booby traps. And we call them IEDs today, of course. Right, but, you know, one of the things that I wanted to try and convey in the book, and I've had several people write to me and tell me that it was spot on in this respect, was, you know, if you run patrol after patrol after patrol, and in very, very many of them, a guy is killed or maimed by a booby trap, and yet you never see anybody to fight, to shoot back at. You're going through villages where you don't know if the people in them are good guys or bad guys. That'll really play with your brain after a while, and it will make you a much darker person than you were when you got there as a young, pretty decent guy. And that was something that I wanted to convey, and something that I thought, and in fact, I've had a couple of vets, younger vets now, tell me that they really appreciated the depiction in the book. I'm talking about Iraq vets or Afghanistan vets.
Right.
Is that the analogies are still there, that, you know, you're fighting in areas where, again, today they call them IEDs, you're losing friends, you're not seeing anybody to, if you will, take it out on or to accomplish anything with, because you don't accomplish much walking over the ground and just waiting to see if a booby trap is going to get someone. And so it changes your attitude about what you're doing. And some of the young guys that I've gotten emails from or letters or whatever that are vets of our more recent wars, talked about how, you know, very much the same. So, you know, different generation, same issues. And you had said something about me getting communication from both Vietnam vets and other folks. And that's absolutely true. That the single biggest thing, which has been both surprising and gratifying to me, is the number of guys that have told me one of their own stories and then got on to say that they couldn't thank me enough for writing this book because it helped them think through things that they hadn't been able to for years, whether that's Vietnam vets or guys that have been in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's the latter that has really, really pleased me a lot, not just us old codgers, but you know, the young guys that have done a couple of tours in these different places and different wars and are finding that the book talks to them in ways that they didn't really have access to before. I've gotten a number of letters about that, which has really surprised me, but it's, you know, it's made me feel that the book's worthwhile.
Well, at some point in the not too distant future, I'll be on the East Coast, and I would love for you to come and see this presentation that I do, because it's based on the traumatic wisdom of guys like you, and I think your conclusions are what veterans need, and they need to hear it from other veterans, and how you get to this thing that I call post-traumatic winning is. You know, you learn about what it is to live with trauma, and post-traumatic growth is that you go through this and somehow or other you benefit from that experience. Post-traumatic winning is beyond post-traumatic growth. Post-traumatic winning says, okay, in the spirit of being Marines, hooray for you, right? We're really glad you're a better human being, but we don't really give a shit about that, okay? Well, we kind of do, but not really. What we need you to do then is now help the team. We need you to take that, what you've learned, and we need you to give it to everybody that you can do. And I think what you just described in those letters that you've got is the life-changing experience, is that, you know what, there's nothing I could do about the things that have happened to me. But what I have done is I've done my best to make sense of it, and then I've shared that. In the sharing of that, I know, and you know this, Mark, you've changed people's lives with that book. And if we as veterans can tell this narrative that we've learned, I believe that we could change the narrative in this country. Every university should hear it. Every high school should hear it. And first thing you need to know, there's a path that you can walk. Guys at the Hanover Hilton walked it, right? They're a great example of this path, of the darkest path that you can go down and yet to come out and to live a great life. So there is a path for you. And I think that's in keeping with the Stockdale paradox, that restores hope. After this black cloud comes into you, I mean, and so many Vietnam veterans who took their own lives, who numbed themselves until they died with alcohol and drugs because they didn't see this path or they didn't even know it existed. And so to me, I find that it's to me become my life work. And I didn't expect it to be. And I didn't even know that it was there until a Lance Corporal's mom showed it to me. And then it's been life-changing. But you've gone down the same path. And how cool is it, though, for you when you get those letters?
Oh, it's just, you know, it's amazing. It just makes, you know, all of the effort and all of the blood, sweat, and tears that went into writing the book just tremendously worthwhile. And I got an email from a fellow that works at a vet center out on the West Coast. And he said that if he had his way, everybody in a dealing with trauma class at the postgraduate level, if you're going to become a social worker or a psychologist, that this would be mandatory reading for them. And, you know, you can't even imagine that somebody would say something like that to you as an author. At least I couldn't. And he's not the only one that said stuff like that. You know, so the book, when it gets read by folks, is having an impact that I frankly never imagined that it would. I thought, you know, maybe it would help some people to read it. Maybe it would be educational about how, you know, what our young folks really do when they go into combat and how they're still good people, still good citizens when they come home, but they've got stuff going on inside their heads that isn't going to go away. And but they deal with it. And that's what I wanted to say from a positive perspective. Right. And yet people reading the book have gotten even much more out of it than that, which to me is just it's amazing and really thrilling that it appears to be helping some folks.
No, life changing, right? That something to think that something you've written could have that kind of an impact on people. And I tell veterans, I said, hey, look, we have a role after we leave. We can be ambassadors for the wisdom that we gather, you know, and then we could help all these people that are in this such a dark place who don't see a path, and we could show them that path. And that will be life-changing for each one of us that does it. And so anyway, so Mark, what happened, what in this hour now and 21 minutes that you and I have been doing this, or in about an hour and 15 minutes, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about the book, about your writing of the book, about your career, and then I've got an email that just showed up, that you want to make sure people know?
I think I wouldn't put it in terms of not smart enough, Mac, but I'd really take – have a difference with you when you said that Vietnam vets weren't necessarily the brightest bulbs. I think we're all geniuses. Okay.
Well, those of us who know you guys, we know different. Okay. But I would submit to you that we are not. We're right there with you on the bookcase, not in the chandelier. So we're right there with you. I got an email from you. I just played, I found, if you could believe this, I found over the weekend two interviews, or an interview that Studs Terkel did with Eugene Sledge, right? The author of With the Old Breed, right? And Studs Terkel, when he was doing his research for his book, The Good War, he had seen Sledge's book and read it. And so he went down to Montevideo in Alabama, where Sledge lived. And it's wonderful. A friend of mine named Jack Riley was a squad leader in India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. He was in Vietnam 1967, 1968, north of you, up in the I Corps area, up near the DMZ. Well, you were in I Corps, but up near the DMZ, and mainly fought against the North Vietnamese regular army. And his name is Jack Riley. And he knew Gene Sledge because they're both from Alabama. And one thing Sledge asked him, interestingly enough, was, have you talked to your wife about this stuff? And so that's what this email kind of refers to. Mac, I listened to Sledge the last 2 days. Oh, my God. How wonderful was that? I also remember Jack Riley saying that Sledge asked him if he had spoken to his wife about it. So when you came home, how did you deal with it? Because men didn't talk about this kind of stuff, right? I think one of your characters resists the whole notion of PTSD, resists going to see the wall because the wall was thought to be another protest vehicle. And you had guys like Jim Webb raise money to build a second monument that's down there. So in your personal experience, at what point did you begin to talk about the experience, in particular with your wife? And that's what the emailer wants to know.
Okay. My homecoming was a bit different from a lot, I think, because I came back into the bosom of the Marine Corps and spent another 4 years, almost 3.5, I guess, as an active duty Marine surrounded by Marines. And certainly in those days, I'm not aware of anybody that talked to anybody else about it. We may have swapped some stories about some different things, but I think it wasn't until I began working some with some Vietnam vets in the early 80s that so I was home, a dozen years by that point, I guess, that I started talking about it at all. And I think that it kind of grew from there.
At what point did you talk to your wife about it?
I'm just thinking back. I've been married twice. My wife, Claire, and I've been married now for 37 years, but I was married for a short time after Vietnam. And I don't believe I talked to my first wife at all about Vietnam. In fact, she asked me a question one day, and I actually remember we were driving in the car, and she asked me a question about Vietnam, and I said, "Well, that's really private. I don't think I should talk about that."
Which is, truth be told, the dominant sentiment among guys, because Grandpa fought in World War II, and he never talked about it. I know that because Grandma says that, and that was the. That was the way men dealt with it. Did you change at any point with Claire relative to disclosure? Because it's interesting, I would tell you, that when we open that door and we allow somebody in there to talk about those events, to me, that's a life-changing event. And it changed Sledge's life, and it led to the writing of the book With the Old Breed. And I could tell you a litany of stories, and the key part in what changes somebody's life is letting somebody else in there. And, you don't have to tell all the details, maybe the first time, but you can work your way to those details if they're important to you. And, but unless people like us tell younger people younger than us that stuff, you discover that stuff on your own. You're essentially groping in the dark trying to find your way. And I think that's the significance of your book and the work that I do is, look, I'm going to tell you these truths. If you don't like it, I don't give a shit. But these are the things you're going to have to do. And one of them is to let your significant other in. And I know that everybody recoils from that. But if human beings require intimacy in general, I think after you go through traumatic experiences, you require that in a larger dose. But you can't have that unless you're willing to let people into your life. They can't know what to do unless they know about you and whatnot. So did you treat it differently with your second wife?
To some degree, in the sense that I think that we talked about kind of snippets of things. Right. But I think it wasn't until, and this is a few years back, but it wasn't until I had done a draft of what ended up being this book. And there are a couple of scenes in it that are, frankly, very personal to me. And I think that it was when Claire had read that draft that made us talk about a couple of things then. So that was a lot of years afterwards.
Right.
I think that I'm, the character in the book starts off talking about, which is, I think, part of why it's relevant to Vietnam vets today, is he starts off talking about how his wife in that book is named Patty, and he says, she doesn't know much of my story, and I think it's time. So in a way, it's a story told through the eyes of a 65-year-old man to people that he really cares about, and he wants to be able to talk about what his life was like when he was 19 and 20 and 25 and 30. And that's what the book is really all about. And I think I can relate to that myself.
Interesting. No, to me, it's as we walk down that path, it's one of those things. And again, I don't know of a class like mine that has assembled, I call the three goals and the 10 commandments of post-traumatic winning. But its power in that is that it's delivered by somebody who's lived it and not by somebody who's talking about it in some antiseptic academic way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can see that.
You know what I'm saying? No, and that's, to me, the power of your book is the fact that you wrote it, the fact that you've groped your way to those truths through the darkness, with help, I'm sure, from some people along the way. But a lot of time spent in anguish and in thought about how do I do this? And then throwing it back in the closet and then taking another step, maybe a year or two or three or four or five later. And so I think it's a fascinating discussion. I thank God for whoever sent me the review of the book and said, hey, get this guy's ass on your show. Even though he is a Vietnam guy and a Bravo Company 1-5 guy. Well, Mark, first of all, I hope you, in the future, you don't mind coming back and talking about this stuff because, in my opinion, we as veterans have a great contribution to make to our culture to let everybody who knows, whether you're a rape victim, if you have combat experiences, the victim of child abuse, is that there's a great place that you can go to. And if you're not afraid to confront the truth, and if you're not afraid to talk about your shit, you can live a great life, and you're certainly evidence of that. And I hope you don't mind if in the future I bug you and come back and bring you back on to talk about these things.
I'd love it. If you do get out here to the East Coast, I'd love to be able to have the opportunity to sit in on one of your classes.
Well, let me tell you, you'll be sitting there because it's all stuff that has come from God. I was the beneficiary of a lot of wisdom from guys like you, Mark, who were I was fortunate enough to have crossed paths with them. And then as I went down this road to try to figure out, why this stuff kept coming into my life, and you can't get away from it. And is there anything, you know, how do you live with it? And so I was the beneficiary of that. And so, I would love to have you come to it. In fact, I'm making a video of it. It's probably going to wind up being about 5-hour video. So when I'm not as encumbered by time restrictions, when I'm presenting it to human beings that like would tip over if I did it for that long, I will send it to you, and you can watch it as you see fit and let me know what you think, because I think our perspectives on this are very similar, and the power of talking to another veteran, the power of talking to a peer who gets it, and what we can do for each other to heal that, and how we heal each other, and the transformative nature of that for us, I think is extremely important, and we can give that gift to our broader culture, and in doing so, we can change, transform our lives, and hopefully theirs. So, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. In case you can't tell,
I really appreciate you having me on. It's been great.
Where does everybody get the book?
It's available just about everywhere. It's published by the Naval Institute Press. Any independent bookstore has it or can get it. Same with Barnes & Noble, and of course on Amazon. And on Amazon, it's both in the hardback and the Kindle edition. So lots of places if folks are interested.
So just so you know, there's 50 customer ratings, 49 4-star ratings and 1 5-star rating. So
I think that's reversed, actually. There's 49 5-star and 1 4-star.
Oh,
I haven't figured out who the 4-star is yet.
My dyslexia kicking in. Don't make fun of me. We'll find out who wrote those 4-star ratings and get after them for you.
What's with that, huh?
what is up with that? All right. So the book is called A Quiet Cadence. It is a novel about Mark's experience in Vietnam, and then most, I think, just as importantly, post Vietnam, and so the path he lays out is a path that I'm extremely sympathetic to and talk about in Post Traumatic Winning all the time. Is that you can live a great life after traumatic things happened, and in A Quiet Cadence, you see the path that Mark has walked and writes about. So, Mark, first of all, thank you so much for coming on today. All the best of luck to you. And tell Claire thank you for her technical assistance today.
Good thing we had it. Absolutely. Thanks, Mac. I really appreciate it.
You bet. All the best.
Take care.
There you have it. That is Mark Trainer here on a Wednesday. How about that? No, I was reading the reviews of his work and some of the excerpts from it last night, and based on what I've done, I do now for so much of my life, you know, I read this: at the heart of A Quiet Cadence is the damage combat does to a warrior's soul. And that damage is what post-traumatic winning is about. It's about showing people, and again, very independently, Mark goes down the same path that I've gone path down, is that you can live a great life after this stuff happens. But these are the things you have to do. And then it went on. In Vietnam, we tried to compartmentalize our worst traumatic experiences, put everything, the sights, the sounds, the smells, and fears in a box and put that box on a shelf. I heard a firefighter when I did it up in Las Vegas for the Clark County firefighters who had responded to the mass shooting from the Mandalay Bay at that concert. One of the paramedics, who's one of the first guys on the scene, calls that his fuck you box. He said, you know, I tried to put this stuff in my fuck you box and throw it in the basement. He said, but that thing won't stay in the basement. It keeps coming out. And so there's phrases that he uses in the book that that trigger my memories of hearing people talk about this. And then one of the other phrases that the reviewer writes about is early on, Garofano warns McClure about the blackness that darkens the soul as a result of combat. And I would just cross combat out and I'd say as a result of trauma. And you know, and again, as I tell everybody on a regular basis, post-traumatic winning is about leading people out of that darkness. And Mark's book does that. And I think it's wonderful. And I think that we as veterans, we as people that have lived through trauma, you know, can teach people. And, you know, I think, you know, Mark would probably be sympathetic to this. It would have been really cool if when you come back from Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan or after you go through a horrible experience, if veterans sat down kneecap to kneecap and say, okay, let me pull the curtain back and let me tell you what your life's going to be like. But we tend not to do that. You know, we tend to go on about our business and, you know, I can handle my business and pretty soon my drinking, you know, accelerates. And then I go through a divorce and then the wheels begin to come off and life isn't good anymore. And so, you know, there's a struggle there. So to me, and that's what I love about doing what I do now is that, you know, when you can do that stuff before bad stuff happens. And for, I mean, you've heard guys who come on this program and said, you know, I sat through that class and I knew it was a great class, but I didn't want to be in there and I didn't really have any traumatic shit in my life. And then 90 days later, my dad committed suicide. And because of that class, I knew what to do. You know, I mean, how fucking awesome is that to hear? Now, people that come home with trauma from, you know, from fighting the nation's wars, to me, it should be mandatory that, look, you've seen a lot of bad shit. And let me tell you the road you're going to go down. But you can live a great life. But these are the rules you got to live by. If you hop in a bottle or start doing drugs, you know, that is the road to a really, really bad place. Don't do that. And these are the rules. And when you get those kind of rules like I got, the first one I ever got, you're never going to get over this from your company, Gunny, who I've never doubted for a second in my life. It's life-changing stuff. So congratulations to Mark for writing a book that changes lives. So anyway, if you're just tuning in, hour one's coming up next. And talk a little bit about what happened in Wisconsin. My daughter Colleen turned 17 today, so congratulations to Colleen. You'll hear from her. And so don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. And as always, don't be afraid to change somebody's life. Right? Mark Trainor did it. Yeah, and he became an Artie guy too. And he's a Vietnam guy and a Bravo 1-5 guy. If he could do it, come on. Anybody can. It will change your life as you begin to touch the lives of other people. Get after it on a Tuesday. All Marine Radio, out.